This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
So, on this very special episode of Aftershock Central Podcast, we are kind of full Voltron, kind of. Martin's supposed to show up later. You have Travis is with us. I'm Ronnie, of course. And then Cullen Bunn is with us.
Hey guys, how are you?
All right.
Yeah. I like the Voltron reference. Martin, you know, in Voltron, whenever they're fighting the Roe Beast, there's always one lion who was separated from the rest. And then it comes in at the last minute to save the day. So Martin is that lion.
Well,
and if he doesn't show up, we're going to get eaten by the Roe Beast.
Well, he'll come in last minute. I'm not sure about saving the day or not, but.
Well, I was giving him the benefit of the doubt.
I know, that's fine.
Yeah, we can't have Zarkon win, all right?
So what have you been up to, Colin? You have tons of creator-owned stuff hitting markets. You have Kickstarter stuff. You have some Aftershock stuff coming. You're a busy dude.
Yeah, that sums it up. I've been a busy dude. It's been very busy and stressful the last little bit.
Well, it's better than being silent, right?
Yeah, I mean it's absolutely better than not having enough work to do.
Right.
It's just managing to. I've always been pretty good about staying on top of all my projects, and I think the last few weeks with everything going on and some family stuff going on, I do not feel as though I am on top of my work right now, and it's a feeling I do not like.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I can totally see that. And then here we are. You're on this Joker podcast, and we're taking up more of your time.
Yeah, what the hell am I doing?
Well,
it's too late.
It was either you or Joe, so we picked you. So.
All right. Well, you made the right choice there.
So you have Knights Templar. Is that right? See, I knew I was going to mess
went
it up.
Went over this not 2 minutes before we started recording. Knights Temporal.
Okay.
Is the new Aftershock book that I have coming out on July 31st, I believe it comes out.
So not too long.
No, about a month. A little over a month.
Yep.
Just about a month.
And that's kind of like your alternate history type stuff that you've already done with Aftershock?
You know, it's a little different than any of the other stuff I've done with Aftershock. And it's funny. I was just on the phone. I was on the phone with the team at Aftershock the other day and just kind of giving them a rundown on the book and everything. And it's kind of a difficult book to explain. On the surface, it seems to be a story about a knight from the Dark Ages who gets transported through time to the modern era. So that's what it looks like. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot more to the book. There's sort of a twist to his appearance in our time. And this knight starts showing up in countless places throughout history. There are references to this knight appearing in these different times, and he doesn't remember appearing in any of those times. There's sort of a mystery about how he got where he is, and what actually has happened to him or is currently happening to him while he's on this quest.
That sounds awesome. And it,
well, it's got a little bit of a Highlander vibe to it, I guess. There, okay. I try to think of things that were inspirational in the development of this. I could see some Highlander influences, but also some Terminator influences, and I think it's gonna be a story people are really gonna like. I think it's a story that may challenge some readers, because there's some stuff in it that I think is intentionally. I wanted readers to feel the same confusion that this knight, his name is August, this knight is feeling when he's on these adventures, and he has some unique abilities, and he's got some powers and some allies, and all of these things have mystery surrounding them.
Yeah, I love it. I'm glad you brought up the solicitation part of it, because we've said this, like, this is episode 101, and I know, Travis, you can testify to this, but we've said it, like, at least 50 times. Like, when solicitations come out, and you read it, and you think that, or you read the solicitation, and you think you know what the story's going to be, and then you get the first issue of it, and it's completely different than what you thought it was going to be, always in the good way.
Sure. Well, yeah, you don't want to give everything away.
Yeah.
Well, that's the fine line you have to walk, especially with a book like this. You have to explain enough of it that people will try it out without giving away what is in the case of this book, it's a pretty big spoiler and something that I still want readers to be surprised by.
Right. Understandable.
Yeah. Can I advocate for Ronnie a second? And ask if it's possible to work in a little bit of Doctor Who in there somewhere? Like, yeah. If you can put a little Doctor Who spice in there, bam! Doctor
There's
Who.
definitely some Doctor Who spice. I didn't necessarily see that when I was coming up with this book, but one of my editors just recently said that it had some Doctor Who elements to it and reminded them a little bit of The Impossible Girl.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
So I knew enough. I know enough about Doctor Who to know what she was talking about. So I definitely can see that.
Well, that has me more excited than I already was, because that's pretty badass.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be a fun book, and it has some elements that I drew upon from sort of medieval folklore, and then it just has a very interesting twist to it, and you get to see a lot of different eras and a lot of different interpretations of this knight.
So with this one, was this one that you thought about for a while that you had in the Rolodex?
No. You know, my stories, they come into sort of these two different camps. And one is a story that I've been thinking about for, in some cases, decades. And then some are stories that just kind of spring out of nowhere. And a lot of my Aftershock books, they definitely fall into one or the other. Unholy Grail, for instance, was absolutely a book I've been thinking about before it came out for 25 years or more. Dark Ark, I've been thinking about for a little while. But Brothers Dracul and Knights Temporal both kind of sprang up very recently and very rapid. You know, they came... The idea sort of formed and came about pretty quickly.
What about Man, I Am Evil, Dude? Your little short story.
Which hammer?
Yeah.
No, the short story from Shock Volume 2.
Has that come out?
It came out today, actually.
Oh, that's right. I knew it was either... I couldn't remember if it was last week, this week, or next week.
Yep.
Man, I'm Evil Dude has actually been around. I could probably tell you exactly how long that's been around. It started out as a short story, prose story that I was working on years and years ago. And it's just one of those situations where I could, you know, I'd finish the story and the story's there, but I never felt like it worked. And then when we started talking about doing another story for Shock, I revisited that story and I wanted to see if it would work any better in comic form. And it was just a situation where the comic, I thought that it's a story that works really well as a comic, but the original, I just opened it up on my computer. The original short story was written in October of 2003.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's and it just sat in the folder because I was never happy with it as a prose story. I love it as a comic story. But yeah, so it's been around for a little while for such a short piece. It's kind of stuck with me for years.
So here's a question, non-spoilery, since it just came out today as of this recording. But Travis is the eagle eye for us, and like at the end of each issue, if we don't know, you know, how many issues are coming out for Aftershock, they'll usually say to be continued or to be concluded or whatever. But at the end of that one, it says the beginning. So is that something that could spin off on its own?
You know, it possibly could. I think it's a story that obviously had that leads somewhere, I guess.
Yeah.
But right now, I don't have plans to pursue it any further. But never say never. I may very well decide to come back and do some more with it. It's just not something that I've really put a lot of thought into at this point. I was kind of just happy with it as a short piece.
That makes sense. I loved the short story aspect of it, but I also loved that little ending too, to like keep it open ended. If it was,
oh yeah,
to go,
look,
you know,
if people come back and really want to see more about that story, I'm certain I could make that happen. If there's definitely a demand for it.
Right. Well, like your story from Shock Volume 1, Blutterflies, that one was kind of open shut case.
Yeah. And even that one, I see, it's weird because that one I see is more open than Man, I'm Evil Dude.
Oh, really?
I do. I think but it's just a matter. That's one of the things I love about these kind of these short stories and these anthologies like Shock in particular. Is I think that those kinds of stories can just they kind of can spark the imagination and you know, one of the things I always loved about, you know, magazines like Heavy Metal and Epic and things like that was that I always wanted more, and me thinking about those stories and what I would do, you know, taking some of those stories further than they were on, you know, on the printed page, has always it's always been fun for me.
Yeah, because it's like little quick hits, and you're like, man, that was good, and then maybe it'll have legs later.
Yeah, you never know. Maybe in another 15 years, 16 years, I'll return to it again.
Yeah, so I'm curious just about that, like, you know, what is there a catalyst for the stuff that's been simmering for a long time, to get to a point where you say, oh, like, is this like a eureka moment where you solve it and then you're ready to put it to paper, or like, and then kind of how that maybe, you know, then gets to the publisher? Like, do you write it all out and then take it to, you know, Aftershock or one of the other publishers, or, you know, do you kind of say, I think I can do this, like, and make the pitch and then write to it?
Yeah, usually these days, you know, back in the good old days, I would have to put together a very, very detailed pitch packet for a project. These days, I kind of have some rarefied air where I can pitch a book with just a few sentences, depending on the publisher. And they put some trust in me that if I say this is the story I can tell, you know, then I can do it. And a lot of my Aftershock stuff, the early stuff, I put together a document. I don't know. At the time, it was probably 8 to 10 pages, just full of ideas. And these were just ideas that have been simmering for a while, or maybe not that long, but it's just I collected, you know, all. I have a document called, you know, basically Cullen Bunn Proposals 2019. And it has all these different ideas that are about, you know, maybe a paragraph or two, sometimes in extreme cases, 3 or 4. But when I first started working with Aftershock, I basically handed them that document. And I said, tell me what you like. and they picked the things that I never thought anybody would pick, which is funny. And then since then, you know, we've wrapped up a project and Aftershock has asked me to pitch them something new. And I'll, you know, depending on the book, I'll put together a couple of paragraphs and send it to them just to see if they like the concept. And if they like the concept, then we're off to the races.
Yeah. So you kind of, do you have so much going on at all times that you don't really have so much time to dedicate to just stuff that's been floating around? Like, are you always actively like, I'm going to flesh this out, you know, like when you know you've got an outlet for it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily, dig into some of those older concepts, even if they've been around for years. In some cases, they've been around and I keep noodling with them and adding to the idea or changing it a little bit, but I don't put together like a formal proposal for it unless there seems to be some interest in it. And if there's interest, sometimes publishers will say, we like this general concept. What would you do with it, you know, for a 5-issue series or a 10-issue series? And then I'll go in and I'll really dig into it a little more, dig into the characters, dig into the beats of the story. But I don't do a lot of that. I don't necessarily revisit those stories a lot until it comes to a time that I'm actually actively trying to get something going on with it.
Like,
I'm always coming up with new story ideas. I try to write a few paragraphs of new story concepts every week. I try to develop at least 3 or 4. Again, when I say develop, I'm talking about a few paragraphs. And some of those are really bad, and they're never going to see the light of day. And some of them are things that I will eventually try to do something with. But I think there's value in just spending a little bit of time just brainstorming new concepts and new ideas.
Wait a minute. Don't say never. Remember?
I know. That's true. That's true. One of those crazy concepts could end up being published one day. I thought Dark Ark would never see the light of day, and there you go.
Yeah, that was going to be my example, but yeah.
Dark Ark is the one that I never imagined any publisher being insane enough to go for. And not only did Aftershock go for it, you know, we ran a 15-issue series, which is, you know, in this day and age is pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to relaunch with a new Dark Ark series in October. So I shows what I know.
Yeah, and that's I think that comes out on my birthday, so happy birthday to me on that.
I planned that. I planned that for you.
Yeah. So kind of on like what Travis was saying, or like Dark Ark, when you have Shock, for example, Volume 1 or Volume 2, are those new stories, which we've obviously answered but how do you pick some of the old ones to actually go into an anthology period, I guess? Because you did a Kickstarter anthology, and then you have a Kickstarter out now. But
it's not my Kickstarter that's out right now, but it's a smaller publisher, and I have two stories in it. That's Graveyard Slaughter. I don't know when this episode airs, but it's live on Kickstarter right now, and you should check it out. it just all depends. With Shock, it's so wide open. You know, it's basically they wanted stories that would make people think and stories that could, you know, entertain people, and there was no that was not necessary to tell a story that had to turn into something bigger, you know. The first one, first Shock with Blutterflies, I just wanted to I wrote that basically right after they asked me if I wanted to be part of the book. I wrote that story just sitting there at my desk, and I just wrote it out. With Man, I Am Evil Dude, I was when that came up, I went through, I have a file of short stories that I've written that had go back, you know, decades. And I just went through that file just more for inspiration than anything else. And I stumbled on that story, and I thought, wow, that maybe this is an opportunity for me to tell that story in a different way or in a better way. So that's why I gravitated to that one. You know, in the next Shock, I will probably write something brand new. I don't think that I will be doing, you know, I don't know that I have any other short stories that I'd want to try to adapt like that. With Graveyard Slaughter, for instance, the book that's on Kickstarter right now, that came about when I first moved to this area. There were a group of writers and artists who asked me to get together with them for dinner one night. And a couple of these guys, a guy named Kevin Watkins and a guy named Adam McLaughlin, had done, you know, books on Kickstarter before. Mm-hmm. And they had their own press called Lunchbox Press. And they invited me and Gary Bedell and Javier Salteres, who are all local guys, to come and talk about maybe we should do an anthology together. And one of the things I liked about that was it was just all a bunch of people from that basically are in easy driving distance from me, that we, you know, just it's sort of a local project. And they they said right from the start they wanted to do a book that had the feel of 80s direct-to-video horror movies. the kind of things that you would see in a video store back in the 80s. And I came up with one of the stories from that anthology sitting at the table, and I said, okay, guys, let me run this by you. And I pitched the story to them right there, and they liked it. And I wrote it, you know, within the next night or two, I wrote that story. And that's the one that Gary Bedell drew. It's called Kill with One Eye Open. And then I did another one that it took me a little longer to write with Javier, and I knew Javier wanted to draw barbarians. So I did a horror story that involves a video game about barbarians called Barbaric Days, and that gave him the opportunity to draw barbarians but also do a horror story for us. Two of the stories in that were written by me, and I like I said, I developed them with the very specific guideline of the project in mind, and two are written by Kevin Watkins, and then we have just various artists working on them.
Yep. And
that sounds like an amazing premise for an anthology.
Yeah, it's a fun book. It's been fun for us to work on. And, you know, it's nice for me. You know, I get to work with the great Javier Salteres. He's an amazing artist. I mean, Gary Bedell's awesome, too. And I've known Gary. I don't even want to think of how many years I've known him. I mean, I knew him long before I was ever working in comics. because I used to see him at conventions and everything. And Javier, I've known sort of distantly at conventions. I'd see him and say hello and everything. But now, you know, now I get to we get to spend time and talk and hang out. And it's fun to see him getting excited about, you know, a project. And now we're all of us are, you know, putting together new ideas for a second Graveyard Slaughter. So it's just been a fun, exciting project.
Yeah. And to go full circle, your Kickstarter, actually, The Passage in Black, was your old stories that you had filed away, right?
It was.
And yeah, it's just so, reinterpreted by other people?
Yeah. So a couple of years ago, I put out a collection from a publisher called Omaha Bound. They helped me put together a collection of short stories. It has like 23, 24 short stories in it, prose. And these are horror stories that go back to, I mean, they go back decades in some cases. Some of my earliest work and some of my later short stories are in this collection. And that book, the prose collection, had illustrations by an artist named Tim Mayer. And at a convention one day, Tim and I were talking, and he said something about it would be cool to see some of these stories adapted into comic book form. And I immediately asked the publisher, Omaha Bound, if they'd be interested in helping me put together a collection of comic book stories based on my short stories. And I didn't write them. I got a bunch of new writers that deserve more attention and relatively new artists and people you may or may not have heard of. And we did 10 stories. Most of them are adaptations of my work by other creators. And then there's one new short story by me in it. That was a fun project to see different writers and their approach to my story and how they would put one of my stories together in a limited, you know, comic book forms are pretty limited. So they have to condense and figure out what the most important parts of the story are and how do they tell it. So it was a lot of fun to see them do that.
Well, I have a follow-up question to that, and then Travis can fire away. So was it successful enough to do a volume 2 of that?
Yeah, maybe. You know, I've learned a lot. I've done 2 Kickstarters of my own now, and both of them have had significant challenges in different for different reasons. And even you know, one I did the Metro Kickstarter. We did months and months before the Passage in Black Kickstarter. And they're both going to deliver around the same time because we learned so many things. But even now, going up to the wire, Passage in Black, a huge number. You know, I'm going to pick those up this weekend. I'm going to sign them this weekend and get them in the mail and get them processed and everything. But when we got those back, a ton of them had gotten ruined in shipping. So we had to go back to the printer and have them reprint a bunch of copies, and it's not going to delay us. But those are the kind of things that I didn't necessarily anticipate. And Metro, same thing. They didn't get damaged in printing, but we got our soft covers back, and the covers don't look right. So we have to take them back, and we have to fix that. And it's just these things that are, you know, that come up that I didn't necessarily expect. So the answer is yes. It's just I've got to make sure I take the things that I've learned from these, you know, the 2 Kickstarters I did and apply them to the future ones to make sure that they run a little more smoothly.
Now, did you guys have a printing company lined up and then they were like, no way?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that was part of it. I think I heard Q like on his podcast say something about it. So
that's there were so many weird complications with Metro, but yeah, one of the worst was we had a printer all lined up, ready to go, And then they came back and said, you know what, based on the content, we don't feel comfortable publishing this, printing this. So they turned us down. So we had to find a new printer. And it was actually, we had the first printer, because we're bad people, was overseas, because it would save us some money in printing. But we ended up going with a domestic printer because, it's much faster and more expensive, but much faster. But yeah, we had a little bit of problems with that. People didn't that original publisher didn't feel comfortable with some of the graphic and disturbing content of that book.
That makes sense, because I've seen the PDF copy of it. So,
well, even Walt, Brian, and I got in arguments. So not arguments, but debates over it, because we weren't sure. You know, when we Brian and I were in San Diego a couple of years ago, and we decided to do a preview edition. and I remember Walt called us and said, if you guys publish this and just give it out in San Diego, none of us are going to work in comics again. So we ended at the last minute, we ended up putting these censorship boxes all throughout the preview edition, because we were all nervous that it would kill our careers if people saw it disturbing it.
Travis, I know you're going through your virgin voyage of the Six Gun right now. Is there anything that you have questions about?
Yeah.
I know you have dark art questions, or no?
I mean, I didn't really prepare any story-specific questions.
Great job, Travis.
You didn't get the Google Docs?
Should I send you some softball questions?
I mean, I got some questions, but all right. I will preface that by saying that I did read a lot last week, like including, you know, about half of The Sixth Gun and all of, let's see, Bone Parish and Unsound, and about half of, what is it, Night Trap?
You read Night Trap too? Wow. All right.
You should have read the best Cullen book ever, and that's Deathly Follows.
Okay.
That is a good one. But it's interesting. It's just, I mean, those are all good choices. Night Trap stands out to me as an outlier in that collection of books you just mentioned. But
I was like going through Hoopla and just picking anything that it was creator owned.
Sure.
So you know, I just wanted Night to get
Trap,
a pace.
Let's just go ahead and get Night Trap out of the way. Night Trap is not a creator owned book. It's actually, I was hired to adapt a video game from the 90s. Called Night Trap. Night Trap is a video game that kind of was famous or infamous in the early 90s. It was one of the first video games that had like real video footage in it. So instead of video game characters, it was actually, you know, it was footage that had been filmed almost like a movie, a very bad movie. And Night Trap was about a group of girls who go to stay in a big mansion, and there are these dudes in the these monsters, vampires, something in the mansion that are trying to kill them and drain their blood. And you, as the player of the game, control pits and things that can capture the monsters. And if you don't capture the monsters, they go and they kill the girls in terribly graphic scenes. And the video game got a lot of heat for being too violent and promoting, you know, death and murder, and it was one of those that was kind of at the forefront of that movement to censor video games in a bigger way. But when I was hired to write it, I just told the publisher, it was Lionforge, and I just said, guys, there's no way to tell that story and be true to the video games. because the video game, the conceit of the game, like I said, you're controlling these pits, but you're a security detail that's watching the house through video cameras. And I kept asking myself, why aren't they going in and getting those poor women out of the house? Because they're just letting them be hunted down by these monsters. So Night Trap is actually based very, very, very loosely on that video.
Okay. I guess that opens the door to a larger thing that I was curious about, which is just about kind of like, obviously you write, you know, kind of work for hire stuff on existing properties, and you also have creator owned stuff.
Sure.
So I'm kind of curious about your attitudes towards both, because I would imagine it's very easy to not easy, but attractive to write for a big book like X-Men Blue or something. And I bet that a lot of people probably come and talk to you about how much they like that book, you know? But it's probably less personal than a creator-owned book. I would also just be curious if there's any work for hire or existing franchises that you would like to write that you haven't gotten a chance.
You're absolutely right. I mean, so there are absolutely things about writing work for hire books that I enjoy. These are characters that I have grown up reading. They're characters that I enjoy. X-Men in particular was a book that was important to me when I was growing up. So I was very, you know, I was honored to write, you know, that book while I had the chance. And there are plenty, there are so many books like that that the characters that I would love to write. Any of the horror characters like Swamp Thing, Werewolf by Night, Man Thing, Tomb of Dracula, you know, any of those types of characters, I'm chomping at the bit. Hellblazer, I'd love to write, I'd love to do a run on Hellblazer. You know, I'm doing a bunch of books for Valiant right now, such as Punk Mambo, which is just such a fun book for me. And it's one of those things, you get offered these books, there's a part of me in my reptile brain that wants to take them all. You know, I want all those books because it just sounds awesome and it's fun to play in that sandbox. And some of it's nostalgia, some of it's just wanting to be part of something, you know, part of that shared universe. But it's hard to compete with the joy of telling your own story in your own way at your own pace. It's difficult enough to do in any comic book form that you get to tell the entire story the way you want it to. You know, with Six Gun, we did a 50-issue run, and that's almost unheard of with, you know, creator-owned books. Mm-hmm. And Harrow County was 34 issues, and again, that's almost unheard of with creator-owned books. But there is a level of satisfaction and joy with writing those books that, unfortunately, work-for-hire books just can't compete with. It's very difficult to get that kind of satisfaction from those books. I don't want to sound like I'm taking anything away from those, you know, from work for hire. I love doing them. But the truth of the matter is, creator-owned stuff is always going to feel a little more rewarding, I think, in my experience. I think it's a little unfortunate. You know, we kind of live in a time where, for validity's sake, you have to do work for hire books because a lot of readers don't think you're a valid comic book writer unless you're writing X-Men or writing, you know, Spider-Man or Batman, which is honestly a little bit bass-ackwards thinking, but okay, I'll accept it and move along. But, you know, it's so to some degree, it keeps you on the right. Doing work for hire books helps you stay on the radar of some of these writers or some of these readers.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's kind of there's other examples, you know, right now of kind of, you know, writers that have gone the work for hire route and really built up their following, and then they're like, actually, no, now I'm all creator owned. Like Jeff Lemire seems like a pretty prominent example of that, you know. And once you prove that and you find a following, then you're like, and you can follow me where I can tell my own stories.
Yeah, and it's different for, you know, for every creator is going to be a little bit different. And there are some creators who go out there and they can really make a mark of their own on some of these work for hire projects. And I try to do that, and I feel like I've successfully done it in a couple of instances, but it's not necessarily as easy as you might think. And some writers stay with work for hire and that's primarily what they do. And some writers move away from work for hire and do primarily creator own. And some try to find some sort of balance between the two.
Do you think today's day and age is kind of like the 90s when independence and creator owned stuff was booming?
Well, I think that we have we just have an abundance of amazing creator-owned and independent content out there. And there's some really awesome books being published across the board by publishers that, you know, we've got Image and we've got Aftershock and Boom and Dark Horse are publishing some great material, and material that just goes in so many different directions and in different genres and different styles. I think we're very lucky in that regard. Mm-hmm. I think there's a ton of it out there, and that can be difficult because it can be difficult to be seen, you know. And that's even before you throw in the idea of Kickstarter, you know, or and people doing self-publishing. It can just be very difficult to catch the eye of the reader because there's so much stuff on the shelf.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you even have a story in the anthology for, what is it, Blue Wave World?
Oh, what is that anthology called? And I don't want to sound like I don't even know where my work's been published. That book came out as a Kickstarter years ago. And then Wave Blue World, I guess, is now the publisher of that book. So it came out before it did not come out originally through Wave Blue World. And then I guess they took it after the Kickstarter edition, and now they are the publishers of it.
Okay.
But yeah. So, and I wish I cannot remember, it's the Broken Frontier, anthology.
Right.
But, yeah, it was originally a Kickstarter that I had a story in. And I love writing those stories. You know, I love writing short stories. They're just very, they can be, that's probably the most challenging thing to write in comics, I think, are those short stories.
That makes sense. You got anything else, Travis?
Yeah, I got a super important question, actually.
Uh-oh.
I'm ready.
Okay, so, I mean, bringing it back to the Aftershock thing to finish. Is it possible that most or all of your Aftershock series maybe exists in a shared universe?
Yeah, you know, that I've been asked that question a few times. It's absolutely possible. I mean, there's nothing. So I've looked in, you know, I've looked at the rules of these, you know, that have been presented in these stories, the rules of, for instance, vampirism in Brothers Dracul, or the rules of sorcery in Unholy Grail. And as yet, I don't see anything that really conflicts with each other, you know? So it is absolutely possible that all of these worlds could collide at some point or do exist separated only by, you know, the expanse of history and time. So, you know, maybe so.
Okay, so definitely is what you're saying is they definitely are a shared universe. Cool.
All right, if that's how you take it, then I'm gonna say that's great. I'm saying it could be a shared universe.
Well, I mean, you have August now that it's coming out, and
he could be the bridge, right? If he appears in all these different times, he could be the bridge. And then he suddenly appears on Shrey's arc in Dark Ark, and then all bets are off, you know?
Yeah. He could be one of those asshole-ish angels that came down to talk to Shrey.
He's not an... Well, he's not an asshole-ish angel, but you did just give me the title for my next Aftershock.
There you go. Do you want to plug anything before we sign off of here?
Well, yeah, I would just say, you know, Knights Temporal is coming out in July from Aftershock. And then in August from Aftershock is Dark Ark After the Flood, which is a new series that is also a continuation of the original Dark Ark's book. In addition to those books, you know, I have... in July, I have a couple of new books coming out. I have I have Unearth, which is an Image book that comes out in I can't remember the exact date, mid July-ish, which is a action horror story. And then from Dark Horse, I have a book called Manor Black, which is sort of a gothic soap opera horror story that is coming out from them. So July's got a lot of new books for me coming out. So keep an eye out for them. And tell your comic book retailer that you want them desperately.
And you have Punk Mambo right now for Valiant coming out.
Punk Mambo is the issue 3 came out today. So as of this recording.
Yep.
So that's coming out from Valiant. It's if you like Hellblazer, like the good old days of Hellblazer, I kind of feel like Punk Mambo operates in that sort of vein and that genre, so you should check it out. It's a fun book for me, even if you're not familiar with the character. She's been around in Valiant for a couple of books, but I'm really taking it as if I created the character and I'm just running with it.
Awesome.
Yeah, Punk Mambo's legit.
It is. She is legit.
But I mean, she's legit, and the book is legit.
She would kick you for saying that.
It's lit, as the kids say these days.
She would definitely kick you if you said she was lit.
And you and your wife have a podcast on this network too, The Bungalow.
The Bungalow. We're recording a new episode tomorrow. Yeah. So, it's a fun podcast where we just talk about... you know, we started it saying, let's talk about what it's like being married to a comic book writer. But we really just talk about all sorts of different things, every kind of topic. And we just have a lot of fun doing it. But yeah, we're recording a new episode tomorrow. So it's a fun little podcast. I actually was this past weekend I was in Heroes Con in Charlotte, and I had a couple of people come up to the table and say that they really liked the podcast. And then I was out buying comic books just by myself, just walking around, and I was buying some old magazines, and this guy just looked over and he said, "Hey, are you gonna talk about this on the Bungalow?" And I said, "Well, no." I said, "Well, if I am, I'm not telling my wife how much I spent on these books."
And then you also have Missouri Swagger, the YouTube channel.
We have Missouri Swagger, but that's a YouTube channel I run with
Dennis. Don't call me Hopeless Hallam anymore.
Yes, Dennis Hallam.
Yeah,
and we haven't recorded in a little while. Just life has kind of kind of been rolling both Dennis and myself around, but you know, we do plan on kind of coming back for a new season of that and sticking to it. It's just a matter of getting all our other business kind of taken care of first.
Yep, understandable. Especially with as many books as you both combined have coming out together. Or not together, but combined.
Yes. So, we gotta keep busy, man.
Yep. And then plus, you know, you have to podcast with Cindy or you'd be in trouble at home. So that trumps that one too.
That trumps that. you know, but yeah, we're gonna get back to Missouri Swagger at some point. At least Dennis and I both tell each other that. Yeah. So
all right. That wraps it up for us. You're at Cullen Bunn, right?
Yes. Yep.
On the Twitter machine?
Yep. At Cullen Bunn, and my website, which needs to be updated, is in the middle of... I haven't updated in a while because I'm getting ready to do a big redesign of the whole site. But it's just CullenBunn.com, so it should be easy to find.
And this show is at Aftershock Pod. I'm at Rombar316. Travis, you are at The Great Magnet. Is that right?
Yep.
And then Martin, who didn't show up tonight, no call, no showed. He is at Geekspine.
Well, we got eaten by the Roe Beast.
Yep.
Thanks, Martin.
Yep, the pink lion didn't show up.
I don't think there was a pink lion.
No, there wasn't. Who was the little dude with the... There's always in all of those anime, there's always sort of the Kiop from Battle of the Planets.
Yeah.
I don't know who that was in Voltron, but that's you tonight, Martin. Yeah. You're the Kiop of Voltron.
Ooh.
And Travis and I will be back. Martin's going to take the month of July off of podcasting, even on his other shows. So Travis and I will keep this on the float. We're going to do our normal weekly reviews, and then we're just going to have a special episode of Shock Volume 2 where we pick a couple of stories and talk about that like we did the first volume. So until next time, Travis, you're not going to do the...
I was sitting here waiting. I was like, is that it? That's their sign-off until next time?
Shock the world.
There we go.
Because usually I do it, but like I can't do both of them. I felt like
you can't do that.